It's that time of the year again, when your nice hosts take a few weeks off. The show will be back with new episodes at the end of February, but each week until then, we will be re-airing some of our favorites from 2024. This week's nice replay is episode
361,
The Lensing Effect of the Window, Theming versus Aesthetics, Paris, originally published August 22nd, 2024. I picked this one because I got real specific about a topic, and I kind of want to do that more frequently, so I'm using this as a reminder. And I guess I'm using it as, at the listener's expense, which isn't true because this episode's a banger, so it doesn't actually matter.
Well, you did threaten is like, this is going to be a I'm going to do this a lot.
Yeah.
And that was many, many months ago.
Yeah.
And so when the show's back with new episodes, are you going to make good on this promise?
I mean, I did do it a couple of times in the past.
Yeah.
They're not in these nice replays, but like, you know, listeners who have been caught up, you know, they're in the know.
They can find
know,
them. Yeah.
Yeah. But I do want to do it more frequently. So that is kind of the goal.
Maybe you should do like a series like we did in when we went and did like a series on cheating.
Oh.
Just saying.
A series. I got time. Oh, to think about another. And I ate it.
Well, the way the cheating one worked, another, I think, was. Yeah. Ellen's like, let's talk about cheating. And then the next week, Ellen's like, let's keep talking about cheating. We're like, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's kind of how it happened.
She sprung it on us. So that's really, that's the framework you can follow. It's yeah. There's no need for great planning.
Okay. I'll think about it.
Speaking of things Ellen springs on us, the other topic in this one, theming versus aesthetics.
Yes.
I thought was really interesting.
Yes.
Because it brought language and a lens from another industry into games, or at least on our corner of games. In a way that, like, I know for me was like a little hard to grasp at first, and I really liked that being able to see it from just another, like, another way, another definition.
Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the defining things that we talk about on the show all the time is everything, right?
Uh-huh.
So, like, that we stumbled upon somehow. So, like, I think that is just another way to emphasize it. So that topic really helped with that. I think that's good.
Ellen, is that something you'd want to revisit the way Steven would once revisit?
I mean, ask me like the day of and I'll be like, yeah, I can say more on that.
Cool. The show will be back with new episodes at the end of February. While you wait, you can get these nice replays and all of our episodes ad-free plus exclusive bonus audio that's pretty nice too at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. Sometimes when we do the intro, it's really difficult for me to keep a straight face. I don't know the way you're like, what is it? Deflected? Had me crack it up.
I'm the model of professionalism on this program, I'll have you know. Wait, those asides were recorded? Oh, no.
Oh, boy.
We're still rolling.
So, yeah.
We're still rolling, yes.
So, Steven, it's a little hot and muggy here in the clubhouse.
It is.
We got nothing on Ellen's little home studio in Duluth.
Yeah.
Which I can see it's simmering off the side of your face.
This is the sun coming through the window. But yes, there also might be some steam. So, turns out that in the high summer, in the mid to late afternoon, like right in the evening, the sun just freaking comes right in my window in my office.
Yeah.
Which, typically isn't a problem because I'm not in my office at 7:16 p.m. except for when I want to play games on my computer.
Ah.
Right. Or when I'm recording.
Right.
Right. So like pretty important moments, periods of time. Anyway, it is 85 degrees in my office right now. So I need to this weekend I need to move some things around so my plants are not by the window. Sorry, plants. But like I need to put some blinds up because this is insane. And the challenging thing here is like for the older houses in Duluth typically don't have air conditioning because A, they're old and it's expensive to retrofit old houses with central air.
Mm-hmm.
But also B, it's one of those air conditioned cities because we're next to this huge cold body of water that tends to keep the temperature average, you know, suppressed. Right. So that's relative because the rest of the Midwest during the summer is really hot. And so, you know, if it's 80 degrees in Duluth and it's 95 down in the Twin Cities, that's an example of this cooling effect. But even if it's 80 degrees in Duluth, it might be 85 in my office because the sun's getting this like greenhouse effect. So it's really hot here. I'm sitting and it's sweaty. I'm just sitting. That's all I'm doing. I'm sitting and then sweating.
Sitting and sweating.
I know this is, Steven, you and I agreed we weren't going to do this. But Ellen, have you thought about getting more plants? there's that wall of plants behind you between you and the window.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Maybe you could turn that into like some underbrush, really block out the sun that way.
Yeah.
I do have bigger, taller plants I could bring in here and put in front of the window.
Okay. Yeah. Giant bush or a tree or something.
I do have that. Stick that. I have a dry indoor tree.
Some vines. Yeah. Okay. Well, there we go.
My vines haven't grown tall enough yet.
Oh, okay.
Getting there.
Then, I mean, then you don't have, then your plants won't suffer because I guess they're getting 2% less light if you move them over a little bit. So that'll be nice.
I mean, we don't want you melting up there.
Yes.
Because that would be like really ironic and nobody would believe us.
Melting in Duluth, that's not possible.
The lensing effect of the sun through the window set her on fire. Truth is out there.
We have the live recording. It's on Patreon.
Yeah. Oh, God. Anyway, it's hot. So I've requested a shorter episode at this point in the evening. We'll see if we can make that happen.
Okay. All right. Speaking of sweating, Ellen, you're running a race next weekend?
Yes. Yes. So we're recording off schedule right now, off our typical cadence, because I won't be around for next week, which is typically when we would have recorded. We record every other week right now. And we were going to record next week, but I can't record next week because I will be in Stillwater running a race. Eric and I are sister and brother-in-law. We are all going to try to run a half marathon, and I haven't been running. Eric's been coaching me. It's been interesting. It's interesting to have your spouse as a coach. He's a really good coach. I'm not a great athlete. We still made it work.
Okay.
Is that what he says? He says, I'm a great coach, but this you're not really doing your side?
Like, no, he's a great coach, so he never says that.
Oh, okay.
Okay. I'm just being honest with everybody. I'm not great at being coached. and I'm not very fast. So it's going to be a slow race, but I think I'm feeling pretty good about it. So we're going to try to.
Cool.
We're trying to do it. This last week, he's like, okay, we're a couple weeks from the race, so you got to like treat yourself like you're wrapped in bubble wrap. You have to be in bubble wrap and you can't take any risks. And then we had a day where we didn't run together, which isn't typical. And I felt really good. And I ran way too hard up a hill that was way too big.
Oh, no,
and man. I come back, I'm like, well, that feels really good, but my foot hurts. He's like, bubble wrap. And then, and then like 2 days later, I was going outside into the porch and I forgot there was a step and I fell down and I skinned my knee and I almost sprained my ankle.
Oh no.
It was an accident.
Maybe you do need some bubble wrap.
Yeah. Literally couldn't be a good idea, but it's so hot. I couldn't wear it.
Oh, that's true.
Anyway.
You're talking about lensing effects.
Yeah. For real.
But yeah, so the race is next weekend, and so I'm not recording. I'm going to be running, and I'll let you all know how it goes when you guys come to visit a couple weeks after that.
Yeah.
Right. That's our third piece of Ellen news, is our next recording is going to be in Duluth.
Yes.
And you're going to host us. It's going to be a lot of fun. It's going to be, I mean, for you, it's going to be an ordeal. You're going to have to deal with us,
right,
tend to our needs and all that crap.
Oh my gosh.
For the two of us, it's going to be like a little, little camping trip.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Great.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure if Dale's gonna be able to come. She's got she's volunteering for the Fringe Festival next week.
Yes,
so
Minnesota Fringe.
We'll see how that shakes
Dale
out.
Dale loves volunteering for that, and
that's great. I don't have a transition.
That's it for that topic. I don't remember what it is. We'll play it right here.
Yeah, you know that topic. It's time for the next one.
Ellen, you have a topic.
Yes? I do. I came up with this topic in the bathroom.
Okay.
And the topic is theming versus aesthetics. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I think about aesthetics a lot because it's part of one of my favorite game design frameworks called the MDA framework, which is mechanics, dynamics, aesthetics. Mm. And the more I think about mechanics, dynamics, aesthetics, the more I think it's right and good and useful. And so I will keep bringing it up probably forever on this show.
Okay.
Oftentimes I'm talking about dynamics because that's where the action happens, right? Like
right.
Where your mechanics combine to become a system. But today I'm talking about aesthetics because the aesthetics is like the emotional experience. And that's really like how that's the player's experience, right? Is they experience the aesthetics first and then the dynamics emerge. And lastly, if they're really thinking about it, they might notice the specific mechanics. Whereas from a developer designer perspective, you're thinking about it in the opposite direction. But I also have been thinking about theming a lot because we've been doing, you know, more for our various game jams We do lots of tabletop games too, not just like thinking through design ideas for video games, but like we're going to make a game about bikes, and Dale gives us the prompt and we have to go do that.
Right.
And I think some of the time Dale's prompts are like about a dynamic or a mechanic that we should use, or yeah, about like an emotional experience. But I think a lot of the time Dale gives us prompts that are about themes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I wanted to talk just for a bit about the difference between theming and aesthetics, because I think casually the term aesthetics is often associated with like the visual aesthetics of a thing.
Right.
But that's not how it's used in the MDA framework, which is what shapes my thinking about aesthetics in gaming.
Okay.
So I wanted to talk about the difference between theming and aesthetics, and just kind of come up with some different examples of the same ideas maybe being applied in one way or the other.
Yeah, I appreciate that distinction, because when I hear aesthetics, I think of it visually, and that's it. Because I don't use the MDA framework as much as you. That's good to know. Because, yeah, to me, I was like, oh, yeah, theming and aesthetics, completely different thing. I see where you're coming from now, and I can see that, like, it's not as clear the dividing line between the two terms.
Yeah.
Yeah, almost the way you describe it in the framework is it sounds very similar to theming.
Right.
And so I'm interested as to why this is a versus topic, if it's not just semantics.
Mm.
But I'm getting where you're going with it. Ooh. It's like contextually, and like we are shaped by the terminology we use.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting that it sounds like these are similar topics, but they come from different traditions.
Maybe. Yeah. I can't speak with any authority about a lot of stuff. And I probably can't speak with any authority about the semantic history or both the words.
Sure.
We can link you to dictionary.com and you can do some of your own research. But,
she said sarcastically.
But I do. No, we'll link it.
Uh-huh.
You still got to do the work and click on it. But I want to talk about how I think of them differently, and then people can come in on Discord and tell me that I'm wrong. When I think about in the way I think about it, aesthetics being the emotional experience of the player, theming can play into that.
Okay.
Right. Mm-hmm. Theming is a layer, like a part of the mix, a part of the recipe that fits under aesthetics more than it fits under anything else.
Mm, okay.
So let's maybe think about like a bicycle game, like the bicycle game we were just making.
Yeah.
Sure.
A couple episodes ago, we were talking. It's called the Bicycle Boom, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Bike Boom.
The Bike Boom.
Bicycle Boom. Bike Boom. So great. I want to make more of that game. Anyway.
Ellen, the bikes don't explode. I know that's what what you like about it. Oh,
it's a great idea. Okay. We'll talk about it again when you guys are up here.
Okay, cool.
So like we got a thematic prompt for that, right? Like what was the prompt? You guys remember exactly what the prompt was?
Historical racing game.
Yeah, yeah. Make a racing game.
Yeah, okay.
Setting,
Which is like, give us the theme, but she explicitly told us, think about the theme that's core to this prompt. Yeah, right.
Yes. Racing game in a historical setting. So like racing implies the aesthetic experience.
Yes.
Right? Racing implies it's competitive. There's going to be a time element. You're going to feel that time pressure, and it's going to probably increase towards the end of the game, like the initial session, the round or whatever. Mm-hmm. Those are all things that kind of come, those are all aesthetic factors that are implied by the experience of racing.
Yeah.
Historical is thematic.
Yes, yes.
That's how I think about it, right? So that is going to be something that plays into what your board is going to look like, maybe what you want your pieces to look like, if you were doing something in a video game, it's going to be the art style that you use and the different things that you have on different layers and the textures that you have, and so on and so forth. Like, That's built into the theme. Now in a video game, you're going to, I think, get a lot of crossover in that, because your visual theming is also going to it's going to be alive. It's going to be moving a lot. And that can definitely play into the aesthetics, right? The speed of your animations and your transitions, like how starkly things are contrasted with one another, so on and so forth. Any echoes of other media that your art style is referencing, like all of that will play into the theme and the aesthetic experience. But I think that the bike is a pretty good made. It was like a pretty good example of how I think of these two things differently.
Okay.
Obviously, they all combine into one game experience and then everything becomes everything.
Right.
But thinking about it from a design perspective, when you're constructing the idea and you're constructing the game and you're testing it, that's how I think of the two as different.
Sure. Well, the distinction is important. Well, I mean, the way that I'm understanding it is the distinction is important because, like, the aesthetics are, yeah, the emotional experience that the player is getting. So you get the feeling, I mean, ideally when we build this game further, I guess, you will get the feeling that, like, you are racing a bunch of bikes. And so, like, you get that emotional experience of a race bringing these apples to the people who need the apples. We didn't finish the game. but, like, the theming is, like, the fact that, like, you're going through history on a bike is not necessarily a part of that emotional experience.
See, I guess this is where this explains my confusion earlier, where I was like, okay, these are very similar.
Mm.
Because to me, and maybe this is my big beef with board games, is that themes are often a coat of paint. Like, I played a zombie board game once. I don't remember what it was, which is probably beneficial because I'm not, you know, putting anyone on blast. But, like, the idea was is that you were trudging around and zombies could come out anywhere. And the whole thing was that you were very resource poor.
Yeah.
You only had one weapon, or you have to pick up and find things. And you were basically, you were alone and the other players were far away on the board and stuff like that. But you had tons of cards and tokens in front of you.
Oh, yeah.
And to me, that felt like that's aesthetic in the sense of, like, the actual pieces and actions, and the emotional feeling of having stuff, needing to trade and manage and resource, that's maybe set a little higher up than the mechanics of what does this card do?
Sure.
And how many cards you discard, blah, blah, blah. But I'm also maybe drawing some fuzzy lines here, but, like, and so that's why the theming to me feels very similar to that, because they both invoke that emotional response.
Oh,
in my mind, I probably went on a bit on this in the bike racing episode, where, like, I didn't want to do motorsport.
Yeah.
Even though that's a similar feeling, we could have used the similar mechanics.
Right.
But only the layouts of the pieces and the art could be different.
Yeah.
And it would feel very different, and the experience would be very different.
Yeah.
And it would actually influence and inform your motivations as a player without changing any of the rules of the game. And so, yeah, I'm just too caught up in everything is everything. But, the idea that aesthetics are not mechanics, in the way you described them, Ellen, is in that it's sort of the emotional feel interaction you have with it that are not, it's not limited to visuals.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
That feels like it's got its feet in both worlds of mechanic and theme to me.
The way that Ellen described it, and correct me if I'm wrong, Ellen, to me is that, like, it's the theming is an aspect of aesthetics.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, I think that you're not wrong in that, like, they are connected and somewhat similar, because the way that zombie game, if it was Care Bears, you'd feel a lot differently about the resources, right?
Yeah.
I think that, like, aesthetics just, like, is a larger umbrella that encompasses theme, at least the way that I remember Ellen describing it. Is that correct? Am I talking over you or?
No, I don't think so. I think that you nailed it.
Okay.
But I was trying to think about, like, maybe we need to look at what themes mean again. Because I don't, what Mark was saying also doesn't feel, what you were saying is how I think about it, Stephen, like, that theming is like a thing you can adjust, like you can lean on to give you that really has an impact on the emotional experience, the aesthetics,
right?
And that, like, unfolds in the dynamics and the mechanics are in support of that.
Yeah.
But, like, I was, What got me thinking about, okay, is there maybe another way? Can we find a couple of different ways to illustrate this difference by poking at a couple other example games? We've been talking about the bike game.
Yeah.
It's just one. So one of the things that came, it was just popped up for me is, okay, let's look at Alien Isolation or some horror games, right?
Sure.
So, like, mechanics, dynamics, aesthetics of Alien Isolation, like, the emotional experience is terrifying.
Right.
You know, you feel like you feel very small and powerless, and you are feeling pressure. And
well, and specifically in that game, you feel stalked, right? Like, because the alien, like, learns from what you're doing and is following you around the whole time, right?
Right.
That's the experience, yeah.
Right. Right. And then the dynamics involve all these different systems where, like you said, like the system of the alien creature learning your habits, or, you learning the alien's tendencies to go towards noise and then being able to respond to that. Yeah. And then stupid robots. I found the robots like way scarier than the alien. Okay. Anyway, but just for me, but the alien, when the alien was there, I knew it was going to happen. Gonna die. The robots were there, like, maybe I can find them all, maybe I should. Anyway, yeah, it's just bad. And then the specific mechanics of being able to like pick up and interact with some objects, move around the space, crouch and hide, dealing with the differences in light and the gradients, and then managing your noise, all of that together. The theme, though, like the theming, and I'm just looking this up, according to Wired, Alien Isolation is revisiting this theme that comes up in the movies and in the franchise a lot, of this cold, hostile universe.
Okay.
And then also, yeah, like the, I love their phrasing, the deadening effect of a corporate dominated future.
Okay.
Right. So those are the themes. Now, it's interesting because I feel like you can explore that theme with a totally different set of like dynamics, mechanics, and aesthetics.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
And you could end up with like a very different emotional experience. We talked about the aesthetics being like that feeling of being hunted and being alone and being rushed. I think if you're exploring the themes of a cold, hostile universe and the deadening effect of a corporate dominated future, you might end up with some similar emotions, but not necessarily, right? Right. So I think you could explore those same themes and have a different emotional experience. And certainly you could explore that theme with different dynamics and different mechanics. And so that's why I think of theme as separate than aesthetics, because you can pick it up and you can move it into a different system and it can still be it's a theme, you know?
Sure.
And this is where I think the presence of multiple rhetorical buckets and traditions, I think, gets us, because I totally get it now. Because when, at least in board games, theming usually refers to setting.
Yes.
Right. And so, but you described theme in a much more, I would describe, say, literary sense.
Yeah.
Which it's a more useful use of that term, frankly. That is usually not part of the conversation with board games, perhaps, which isn't to say it isn't something that people consider, but it's not part of the standard vocabulary. Right.
I don't know that I would agree with that.
Yeah.
I agree. I have always agreed with you in that, like, the theming in board games tends to be not great.
Yeah. We're like, certified haters here on Nice Games.
That's why we're nice. I do think that, like, board games do, or I guess I should, I'll back up. I think that players do experience themes in the literary sense of themes.
Yeah, totally. I think it's just not part of the toolbox in it, because there's not a tradition of discussing or working it out. You don't see that a lot in game design documents, and the phrase theming almost exclusively refers to setting and aesthetics when talking about board games.
Okay.
And that's kind of actually what I thought you were going a little bit with, Ellen, but then when you're describing it, was like, oh right, that's the definition you're using for themes, which tends to be much more present in video games.
Yes.
And part of it is rhetorical.
Yeah.
Right? And game designers of all types do all of this, and there are so many untrained people, myself included, who cobble together a working theory on how to produce games. But a lot of times we are constrained sometimes by the language we use to describe what's in games.
Right.
And that is one of the reasons why video games and board games are different, apart from their actual literal difference.
Well, additionally, like, video games tell a literal story, literary story, right? Uh-huh. Like you're experiencing a narrative in the traditional sense. Like, we designed a narrative for you to experience.
Sometimes.
Sometimes. That's not always the case. But I mean, like, video games oftentimes will do that, right? Like, you play The Last of Us, there's a story in there, right?
Sure.
In a board game, that typically is not the case. And you are experiencing...
Because you'd call it an RPG at that point. there are board games that have, like, storybooks, and you read aloud to the other players as the story progresses.
Yeah.
Yes.
Campaign-style board games. But those are often seen as role-playing games with board game mechanics.
Yeah, right?
So I'm not disagreeing with you.
Okay.
I think literally, you're not 100% correct, but sure. I think it's very much seen that way, and I think you're correct to describe it that way.
Yeah. I think that's the distinction between the two that makes it so that board games feel like they don't focus on theme as much. Interesting. It's interesting that we came to this point because we were talking about, you know, the bike boom versus a video game. If we had started the conversation with video games, maybe we wouldn't have come to that point. But like,
yeah,
it's really fascinating. So yeah, I think that like that's interesting. I think I agree with you, Mark, in that like the literary definition of theme is just like what this game is trying to tell the player about. And aesthetics is the emotions that the player experiences while they're playing the game. And those can be two different things, as Ellen said.
Yeah. I think another thing that occurred to me, and then this might be my last little thought on the topic, because I really kind of want to kick it back to listeners to hear more of what they want to say on this.
For
this
sure.
one, I feel like, should, this topic, I hope it sparks great discussion, some debate on the Discord. Anyway, it occurs to me that maybe the reason that the more literary application of a theme works for video games more than it does for board games is because video games have more complex systems and are longer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, like there are hundreds of thousands of words, 100,000 words in a novel. A novel has a theme, clearly. Like there's a story that unfolds. But even for games that maybe don't have a strong story, there might just be more to play with in there. And so, I don't know, something to think about. Or to Mark's point, perhaps, maybe this is just, maybe you didn't make this point particularly, but I feel like you were alluding to it. It just isn't necessarily a practice in the board game industry because it's not necessary to like be successful.
Yeah.
You know?
I mean, that part of that is me, you know, being a little bit, throwing some shade at the board game industry.
Yeah.
With that.
And, sure.
But I, you know, I'm not going to stand down from that position. But Ellen, I think you hit on something that I really do agree with also, which is the longer and more complex. But I think what that does for games that board games don't have is control over time. Like even board games with timers don't really control how long it takes to play that game.
Oh,
right.
Interesting.
And so, and you know, we've discussed pacing recently that's a big part of being able to impart themes.
Yeah.
Be able to do more with your aesthetics because you have more tools for that, and that can build towards imparting themes in a way. And so it's not that it's impossible. And I think perhaps one of the reasons it's not a practice and why it hasn't been a sustainable practice in board games as much is just harder to do.
Yeah.
Not just that no one's thinking to do it.
Yeah.
Or everyone's going along to get along. I do think there's a little bit of that. Ellen, I think you kind of hit it. There's just the tools are not as available. And so it's just harder.
Yeah.
I don't know. Does that sound right?
And I think so. And maybe the pressure isn't there. Maybe the tools aren't there because, you know, you're dealing with physical systems that humans have to operate. Mm-hmm. And humans are, well, some humans are sweaty.
Without naming
and
names.
Other things. Yeah. But yeah, humans have varying degrees of focus and all that. So like, in computers do too, perhaps. They have different degrees of execution, but not so variable as humans.
Yeah.
And so that just kind of limits the thing, like the palette of options you can play with in a board game. Whereas in a video game, you can have the computer do a ton of the work.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So
I like, let's open it up. Like you said, that's a great place to end it on is us being like, maybe. And it sounds okay. And then everybody else, any ideas?
I want to come back to this. Maybe I'll ask, maybe what I will do is I will go to the Discord and I will say, tell me what you think of the differences in this game. Like, it'd be interesting to talk about the differences in aesthetics versus theming for Spirit Island, for example, or some other board games and some other ones that,
like, there are other board games?
Ring. Not for you.
No.
For you. Okay, that seems good. And now we can talk about Discord.
Yes.
Yep.
Yeah, okay, so we talked about theming and aesthetics. You just listened to it. We wanted to ask you to join our Discord so you can continue this conversation and other conversations further. Go to nicegames.club/Discord. You can talk to other people, including us and people who have been on the show and folks in the community, about Well, I mean, specifically, we're asking for theming and aesthetics right now, but just any other topic that comes to mind.
And you may think, hey, I'm only halfway through this episode. It's a whole other topic.
Yeah.
I should wait till then so I have something to talk about. No. Go ahead and pause the episode now. We've already got your downloads.
My topic's not that interesting anyway, so just...
And go to nicegames.club/discord.
Yeah, yeah.
Sign up. Go to the Nice Games Club chat channel and introduce yourself.
Yeah.
What you do in games, what you've worked on, what you're hoping to work on. And give us your thoughts on this topic we just did, or anything else.
Mm-hmm.
We'll be in there, and we'll be in there prompting folks.
Yeah.
But it's a community, and so it needs you.
Yes. Also, if you do have any hot takes on Perry's, actually put that in the Discord. I'd be interested to hear.
Yeah.
What's that URL?
NiceGames.club.
NiceGames.club. NiceGames.club/Discord.
My topic is parries. What is a parry, you ask? Well, I'm going to tell you.
He's not going to keep you waiting.
It's basically what Ellen's doing, I think, sort of. It's effectively like when you press the guard button with just the right timing right before an enemy hits you to like do a super fancy, flashy block. And it like makes it gives you some reward of something.
That is the most backwards way to describe it.
That's what it is, though.
I know, but...
What do you mean?
A parry is when someone attacks you and you redirect it away from you.
That's what it literally is.
Right.
That's true. That's
mechanically, true. That's how it tends to express itself. Yeah. Is essentially a guard that's harder to do and gives you a greater reward.
Yes.
Right.
Right.
But
versus a block where you just
sit there.
Right. Right. Which has tended to be a little bit easier.
Yeah.
But I think it is valuable because this is the kind of thing that has been so internalized, particularly in fighting games, as being mechanically exactly this.
Yeah.
And less perhaps tied to what it is meant to represent.
Right. That's a very good point, actually. Because, when I hear parries, I definitely think of Street Fighter 3, and I don't think of and I'm not thinking about fencing or whatever it is.
Yeah.
I also wanted to bring up just dodges, which is kind of like parrying in video games terms, where you just like dodge at the right time.
Mm-hmm.
It's basically the same thing. I wanted to bring this up because like it feels like a very specific topic, but like I feel like it's all over the place, and it's been kind of all over the place for the past at least 5 years.
Yeah.
Definitely longer.
Yeah.
And so I guess I wanted to talk about it. So I thought of a few reasons as to why a lot of games are doing this now, and I'll list them out here. I think it's a way to reward mastery, or at the very least, like reward players for like paying attention to what is happening in the game.
Yeah,
it definitely rewards player participation because, like, when you're blocking, like typically you're just like holding a shield up and it's like passive. You're just holding a button down or toggling the block action, right? But when you do a parry, you're actively defending. You're paying attention to what the opponent is doing, and you're timing your button press to deflect their attack.
Mm-hmm.
It requires the player's focus and requires specific timing. Dodging is like long form parrying, so it's not exactly the same thing, but like, or in games. I think it's also an approachable way for players to like consider the idea of mastering the game, because oftentimes when the games implement a parrying system, they just use the block button, and if you press the block button with the right timing, you will get the parry. Mm-hmm. But if you don't, then you just block the attack. And so like there's not a lot of disadvantage for attempting it most of the time, unless you like do it too late, then you get hit. But
yeah, I think the two, it's funny when you said like a lot of games are doing this now. I'm like, what are you talking about? And then I remember that Spider-Man 2 added it.
Yeah.
And the reason I forgot is because I'm so good at the Spider-Man fighting system that I didn't use parry once, except for when a mission required it in that entire game.
Okay.
I completely forgot it existed.
Okay.
Because I did not need it ever.
Well, that's good, because like, it tends to be an optional system, right? Like the games don't typically require you to be able to parry.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that sounds like the parry.
That's the other example I was going to say is I'm playing Paper Mario A Thousand Year Door, which introduced the action commands, which is one of the best innovations in those types of RPGs.
Thank goodness for that.
Where you get to do some action gameplay, and it's still very simple.
Mm-hmm.
You hold down A at the right time to block, to guard.
Yeah.
But if you hold down B at the right time, you essentially parry.
Right.
You reverse the attack. It's not just called that, but the mechanic is the same.
Mm-hmm.
And because TVs are no longer CRTs, You always have that LCD delay on a television. Yeah. I know fighting games fans care about this a lot.
Yeah.
But the parry window is so tight in that game that like I can't get it. And it's like, so I gave up on it pretty quick.
Yeah, dang.
And or I could have gone in and adjusted my TV settings, but like I'm not letting a video game control my home theater setup. Like,
fair. Fair point.
That's just me being stubborn, frankly. but you were saying that there's not a lot of punishment for a parry, but in a game like that, it's actually a very risky maneuver that has a high reward.
Yeah. So there's different implementations of parry, and I'll get to that.
Oh, okay.
Because that is very, to me, fascinating. I keep saying to me, because like, I don't know how many people are really excited.
I'm reading ahead. I'm sorry, everybody.
No, it's fine. But I don't know how many people are really excited about getting into the nitty gritty of parries. Uh-huh. But I want to talk about it, so shut up. another reason why I think people are putting parries in their games is because it is rewarding a different type of mastery. Like, a lot of times, I think games tend to be fighting games in particular tend to be combo focused. You want to make sure you can execute the hardest punishes you can. But if you get good at parrying, it's a different set of skills. And if you're good at that, then like you can utilize the different. I guess you can utilize that to do your fancy punish. So you still kind of have to do both, but in a fighting game. But like you don't necessarily have to do both in like Dark Souls or something. Mm-hmm. It's just a different way to master the game. Also, it's hype as heck. I will submit Evo Moment 37 as evidence to how hype parries can be. We will link to that in the show notes if you are not familiar. It's great. I think those are the reasons that I came up with. There's probably more, but let's talk about the different variations of parrying. So there's just dodges, which are basically parries but with dodging. And I think the typical way that people do parries is you press the block button with the right timing, and if you don't, you just get a block. If you do it too early, you just get a block. If you do it too late, you get hit. The other way to do it is the opposite, where you have to let go of the block button to parry something. And if you do it too early, I guess you're blocking. But if you do it too late, you get hit. It kind of rewards it. You have to commit. You're committing to like parrying instead of like committing to blocking and happening to get a parry.
Yeah, that feels more to draw from the earlier topic. Feels more thematic.
Yeah.
Right. Because a parry is kind of two actions.
Yeah.
It's, you know, it's protection, but it's also deflection.
Yeah.
And one has deflection. To come for the other. Right. And so I like the idea of pressing and releasing.
Yeah.
That feels draws me in a little bit more and makes me understand what that is.
Yeah.
And why it's important.
I'm glad you said that, because Smash did both ways, actually, for a brief period of time. So I think Smash 4. Which is the one that was on Wii U and 3DS, had what I'm calling traditional parrying, where you press the button, and if you don't hit it, you block, right?
Right.
Smash Ultimate, the newest one, it does it the opposite, where you have to let go, and it was a pretty distinct change. You can kind of see in the scenes in professional scenes that like people weren't really using parrying for a little while, and they started getting back to it because it was a new system, I suppose. Yeah. But also, like, I think it's kind of interesting because you get punished if you do it wrong, the way you're talking about it, Mark. Makes that.
Yeah.
It makes it more dynamic feeling. Like, you actually you actually committed to it, you actually put in the effort, and you get rewarded or you don't. And you're like, well, I messed up. It feels good. Because I think one of the things that I have an issue with the way parries tend to get implemented is that, like, you'll just happen to block at just the right time, because you're mashing the button and you get a parry for free. That's fine, I guess, because like that's just going to happen anyways. But I don't know. Ideally, I would like it that I felt like I actually attempted to parry and was successful.
Yeah.
So that requires some certain tuning. But the example you were talking about with Paper Mario, Thousand Year Door, is a separate button outside of parrying, I believe, right? Because A button is the block and the B button is the parry. Right?
Yes.
Yeah. And that's where you just don't get any of the benefits. You don't get to block. You just have to do it right, or you get screwed over. Mm-hmm. And you got screwed over a lot. Yeah. Now that I've thrown a bunch of terms and things at y'all, I'm curious how both of you feel about parries. And then I guess I can talk about my thoughts.
Well, you actually converted me on something. Ooh. Because I am bad at parries. Sure. I just like never play a game long enough and good enough to get so good at it where I can just do it all the time, unless it's a Metroid game, and there really isn't a lot of parrying stuff in Metroid games.
Well, Metroid, the new Metroid Dread added that parrying thing, the melee
parry. It did, and and I got good at it.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm still correct.
That's true. Like, I'm in here to say I did not get good at that.
Fair enough. Yeah, I got pretty good at it. And it even doesn't have like a... So,
yeah.
Counterpoint, I did not get good at like Legends of Zelda, like Tears of the Kingdom parrying.
Sure.
It just never felt right to me. And same, like, it always frustrated me. It's like, okay, I have to not block and not protect myself and then suddenly do it right. Like, that feels so unfair.
Yeah.
It's like not what I would do in real life. Like, right. In real life, you're like, you're going to keep your guard up. You're going to protect yourself. And if you're going to parry, it's going to be an additional action that you do on top of your default.
Yeah.
But you just explained why it's different. And that's because it requires there needs to be a consequence for you to get it wrong.
Yeah.
And if you're just blocking and you try to parry and it doesn't work, then you're just blocking again.
Right.
You know, like, I guess you could try to parry and you leave yourself open for a counterattack, but like, then you're talking about a combat system that's not necessarily appropriate for all types of games.
Yeah.
You know, like, now I'm going to think differently about parries now, because like,
yes.
If I miss a parry, there has to be a consequence. I don't think I'm going to get better at him.
I mean, fair enough.
Maybe I won't get so frustrated about the game design behind it.
Yeah. I also didn't parry in Tears of the Kingdom.
Okay.
Who needs that noise?
You actually really don't need it in that game.
I mean, there's some boss battles that really require it. And you don't, and if you haven't been using the whole game, it takes you a while to remember.
That's true.
And then you don't know how to do it because you haven't been practicing.
Right, right.
And it does slow you down a lot, because you could also get away with not doing it sometimes. It just takes 10 times longer.
Yeah.
And I think that's where I'm not fully convinced.
Oh, okay.
Because because I'm not inclined to this as a gameplay mechanic,
sure,
take this with a grain of salt.
Okay.
But to me, it feels like what's wrong with parries is that it assumes you as the player are interested in doing the most damage as fast as possible. Never ever am.
Okay.
I think a failed parry is an opportunity cost.
Okay.
That's a punishment.
Oh,
right.
Interesting.
And I think that's fine. So it doesn't need to give me any further punishment.
You don't need to take damage or anything.
Yeah. It's basically saying, like, you tried a thing and you made no progress.
Yeah.
And for a lot of designers and a lot of players, that doesn't feel punishing enough.
Mm.
Yeah.
Because you can just stand still and you're not losing hit points. You're not being open to attack, that's fair as well.
Less feedback.
Yeah. And I am perfectly happy to guard and bide my time.
Sure.
Like, I mean, yeah. I don't have a lot of time as an adult video game player, but I'm also just not obsessed with beating the boss faster. Mm. Does not interest me.
Okay.
Like, if the boss is on like a timer where, like, you know, like, you know, they, you know, you have to hit the red glowing thing at a certain thing, whatever.
Yeah.
Like, that provides me a framework with which to care about time pressure.
Okay.
And that, I like that a lot, right? But when it's up to me to do it as fast as possible, you will never convince me to put any effort into that.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Like, and so I think that's a big part of what, every time the games introduce this, particularly when sequels introduce it, they act like everyone's going to love it.
Yeah.
Like, it's the system you know, but you have so much more control. You can get things done faster and more efficiently. I'm like, I don't care.
Huh.
Like, I just don't care.
Yeah.
Like, I'm fine doing it. I'm fine with just shooting my web blasters. And, like, I don't know. I don't know if other people feel that way.
Yeah.
But I do know that a lot of people do don't get into the parrying mechanic. Ellen, you're similar. But, like, for me, I really feel like it's just when it goes right, it doesn't feel like a big deal.
Mm.
It just feels like it's a slightly more complicated mechanic for doing similar things to what I'm already doing.
Yeah.
And so, and the reward it very much feels like a quick time event.
Okay.
In a way. So it feels less like I don't know. And that's from game to game, I suppose.
Yeah.
I think it has been very valuable to hear you frame it the way you framed it.
Okay.
Because I'm definitely describing my objections to it as a player, not necessarily as a designer, although a little bit.
Okay.
I feel like I can focus what bothers me about it and why I never really catch on to it better now than I could before.
Oh, well, I'm glad to hear this topic has been useful. I was just like, oh, I'm just going to talk about a thing for 20 minutes.
Maybe
people like it.
We'll make it a regular series, like Steven's like Mechanic Corner.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that.
That'll be fun. Okay. So my opinion on parries is they're fine, I guess. I don't know.
Oh, man. I love that as a conclusion. To that. That's fantastic.
They have a purpose. I don't even think they're necessarily overused. They're a tool that serves a purpose.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know that, like, I think that, like, a lot of, I feel like a lot of people just like put them in and just want to make sure that like they're tuned correctly, right? You just need to make sure that there's enough frames so that people feel like they're actually putting in some commitment.
Yeah, I suppose there's the core objection a lot of people have, which is they very frequently will feel robbed of it.
Yeah.
Right.
If it's if the timing is too tight, then like you're pressing the button and you're just never going to get the timing because you only got one frame or whatever, and that's bad. Mm-hmm. But if the timing is too wide, then like you'll get it accidentally all the time, and then you won't bother to care because the game is basically given.
Then it doesn't feel special.
And it doesn't feel special. Yeah. Right, exactly.
Yeah.
You want to make sure that it's you hit that sweet spot, and that's different for every game.
It's also one of those cases where it's hard to come up with a narrative framework with which to give players a safe space to try it out.
Yeah.
I was just thinking about how to do that, actually.
Yeah.
Oh.
And I have an idea.
Okay.
Ooh.
So, like, instead of, you know, like having you attempt a parry and miss it, then just get like speared through the freaking heart.
Yeah.
And then yank the spear out and you're knocked on your butt.
Uh-huh.
Maybe the first few enemies, like the first few times you're encountering something where you want to test out a parry, you try to do it and you miss it. Uh-huh. And they just give you a very disdainful laugh. And you lean on the fact that like you didn't make any progress, but then like your opponent just like laughs at you or says something mean.
Yeah.
Like
that might be worse.
Well, but you know, like it gives you the feedback that you need that it's you tried this. We acknowledge that you tried it. We also need to give you feedback that you didn't do it right. On the other hand, you're not actually getting mechanically punished for not getting it right.
Honestly, what I like about that is so very frequently the way you learn a parrying move in a game, especially one that introduces it to a sequel, is it puts you in a training scenario where and then it'll pause the game and tell you this is when you do it.
Right.
And that's so frustrating.
Yeah.
But also
it's not fun.
That's not the safe space that the that four stage Mario thing that everyone talks about. Like it's not the if you fall in a pit, there's a place to land.
Yeah, it just
the
gives
next
you,
bit as a whole.
It just gives you a free parry.
It just gives it just lets you try it again until you get it.
Right.
But what I like about Ellen's solution is you could even make it where if you miss the parry and the opponent is like, oh, how clumsy, laugh, and then the opponent is open to an attack.
Yeah.
Like, you actually give the player an advantage because again, in the training part, who cares how well the player does?
Sure, yeah, right.
And so, like, it gives you just enough opportunities to try it, and it can maybe give you a different reward. If you parry, they drop some more money than if you miss. But then you can stab them really quickly.
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
Then there's no drawback, but you still feel like make it a positive reinforcement rather than a negative reinforcement.
Yeah.
And then also it gives you opportunity or it gives you a reason to take the risk if it's a system that has a high risk for the high reward. Mm-hmm. Because in those cases, those games are always balanced where if you don't take the risk, the reward is not needed.
Yeah.
And so make the reward either necessary and give you enough opportunities to do it without punishing you so badly. Ellen, I think that's a good start to making it make more sense. But, you know, all of that it's everything is everything is again. Like, how do you put that into your world? How do you make that make sense in your world? Whereas that's not how you learn how to parry in real life.
Right.
Right.
Well, yeah.
What are the implications for the theme?
Yep. That's our show. For show notes and links on today's topics, go to our website, nicegames.club. Visit us on social media at Nice Games Club, where Dale posts about game dev resources and how much writing software engineers do. Reply on the various platforms, threads these days, or email us, contact@nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. And we've asked a lot this episode. We told you we were going to remind you at the end, and here's the reminder. If you want to keep things casual, if you want to tell Steven he's wrong, if you want to let us know how you feel about themes and aesthetics, and if you have thoughts on parries, just stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello. Next week, we'll be doing something fun because we're all going to be at Ellen's place. We have not planned anything.
Yeah.
No, and we're not going to.
Nope.
Yep.
Except for probably Robustin and...
We'll figure it out. In the meantime, Ellen is going to go take the ice bucket challenge. And until we start again, remember to...
Play nice.
And make nice. Make ice.
Ooh, just under the wire.
Ah. Hot takes.
I don't have hot takes about Perry's. No, not gonna lie.
Please, no more hot. No more hot anything.
cold takes. All right.
Final temperature report. 1 second.
Oh, okay.
This will go after the
credits. It's down a whole degree. It's 84.5.
Oh, so we can go another 20 minutes now.
No, I'm dying.